don't do that in there.
No, you aren't either. It always looks like, I mean, the speaker gets up here, everybody just kind of scatters. You know? I'm Jim Miller, and I'm a very grateful Al-Anon.
Hey, Jim.
Yeah. It's wonderful to be here. You can go down there if you want to, Maddie Lou. It's all right. Yes, the light, yeah, I know the light bothers your eyes, but it does. It always looks like everybody scatters and kind of abandons the speaker up here, you know. It's great being here. It's been a wonderful weekend. Whenever I'm asked to speak, and I speak once or twice a year or something like that, it's always kind of interesting whenever I'm asked to speak, because I can say, okay, well, I'm going to find out why I'm supposed to. And the reason that I was supposed to this time is not to be here, but to be out there. I needed a weekend by myself. I needed a weekend to have a little time. I needed a weekend off. I needed a weekend to be among friends in an informal situation so that I could kind of just be myself and relax. I didn't need to be in a big convention center at some big city going to fancy restaurants. I needed to be at a wonderful picnic lunch down by the Flint River with good old friends. And just thank you so much, Maddie Lou and Ennis, for lunch today. It's great. It's been great ever since I got here. I told Kathy who greeted me as we came in, and I went out to my room, and I had this wonderful note and two kinds of ink from her just welcoming me. I thought that would just meant I was special, but I was worth two pens. But she said she ran out of ink with the first pen. and it is the very best basket of goodies I have ever received anywhere at any time. Okay, I mean, I've got this bucket of drinks and water and different kinds of juices, and I've got this wonderful things you're actually going to eat. You know, things you can actually use. You know, and not just look pretty, but things you can actually have. Now, what I want to do through life is to realize that I'm no better than anyone else and I'm no worse than anyone else. But I think we all like to feel special. So Beth and Michael and Buck and you know, if I want to think that my basket was special, okay? So I want to think that it was made particularly for me. And that is very, very special. So, if y'all got one of these, I don't want you to tell me, okay? Isn't that wonderful? I mean, I've never gotten that in a basket before, you know? That's just great. And I love the slogan, happy, joyous, and free, because that's the way I feel today. You know, it's happy to be here. I feel full of joy. Joy I like to think of as something, you know, I can have fun, but then I can also have joy. I love roller coasters. I love rides, you know. And I can have fun on a roller coaster by myself. But having a friend or one of my children next to me on the roller coaster is joy. Now, yeah, it's fun by itself, but joy is having someone along with me for the ride, and that's just wonderful. That's just wonderful. Diz has been doing a pretty good job. He's been getting his speech about, you know, finding the bathrooms, and, you know, he actually called it a restaurant today, I believe, rather than a cafeteria, you know, when he came up here, you know. So, I mean, he's been doing a lot better, but he's got the tapers wrong, okay, because Brad and Jeff and I have been talking, and he's been telling you that you get the 5 speaker tapes for $20. But we got a special deal going. You get 4 AA speaker tapes for $20, and if you buy those, you get mine free. So I know y'all all be excited about that. I've got a joke to tell. I thought about changing it after Maddie Lou's. I thought, well, I could tell. I thought, well, I've got a real good rocket deal. I said, nah, I'm not sure. It may go a little bit further than that. But we in Al-Anon should tell jokes because we are not particularly known for our senses of humor. It's not kind of at the list of what do you think of when you think of Al-Anon members before Al-Anon or even after Al-Anon. They're wonderful senses of humor. You know, it's not at the top of the list. I think we should. You know, we need to laugh at ourselves because it's a funny thing. You know, humor in the program. You know, it's funny. It's a strange thing how we laugh at times. And the I remember a meeting that I went to early on in Dallas, Texas, when I was in the program first kind of in. And I love this meeting because when I first got into Al-Anon 23 years ago, There weren't very many men. There were some, but there weren't a lot of men. And so I like being with the ladies, but I like the open AA meetings. I really did. And we had this open discussion meeting. There was mixed AA and Al-Anon called the Family Afterward in Dallas at the old Alpha group there. And I loved going to that meeting because I got to sit down and talk to the alcoholics too, you know. And we were at this meeting, and it was relatively early on, and we were talking about humor in the program, and some people made comments like, "Isn't it strange?" He says, "You sit up here and people talk at the speakers, and they talk about all this horrible stuff that happened and how bad it used to be, and we just laugh because we make it humorous, and then we talk about how wonderful it is today, and we cry, you know." It's a weird thing, and I had thought about it, and I spent a lot of time at that time, and I'll still do it today if I don't watch it. Rather than listening to the other people, I was planning my talk, planning what I was going to say. And when it got around to me, I thought I was particularly brilliant because I made a comment about the difference between tragedy and drama in the ancient Greek poets with some particular references to Euripides. I left the meeting and feeling particularly pleased with myself, and a woman who'd been in Al-Anon for a long time came up to me and she said, "Jim, we are here to share our experience, strength, and hope, and not our education. If you don't have any experience, strength, and hope, please stay quiet." And she is absolutely right. She's absolutely right. And so today, my prayer, my sincere prayer to God is always, "God, please help me share me, my experience, strength, and hope from the podium." And yeah, I'll share some good things that I got from other people, but the main thing I need to share is me, because that's the only gift I have, me. Everything else is just something that filtered down through me. Stuff that I've learned from reading, something I've learned from the big book, stuff that I've learned from wonderful other speakers, some things I've read from literature and other areas, but through me. Well, y'all will be surprised, but I remember before I got into this where I started from, but I was going to tell you a joke, about humor, So we in Al-Anon need to have jokes about ourselves. I think we need to laugh at ourselves because I think that's a healing process. I think it was right around here. I think it was either somebody from Bainbridge or from Blakely that a new couple came into the program and just started getting sober, alcoholic husband, Al-Anon wife just going in, and a teenage daughter who'd just been, and she's going to Alateen too, and they'd just been in a few weeks, and things were getting a lot better at the house, and the husband just said, it's just been such a one, things have been so much better, and while I was drinking, I just didn't ever spend any time with the family, and our family's just been apart. Says, "I think we ought to go to the beach together. Let's go down to the beach," and so they started down, and The husband was from this area, so he knew all the little roads, the little bitty roads, because he'd been out as a teenager drinking on those dirt roads and everything, so he was taking all the little shortcuts and everything, and they were out someplace in the middle of nowhere, and the car broke down just as evening was coming on, and so they looked down there, and there's this light over there, and he comes over there, and he goes up to the door, and he says, any way we can call someone to fix the car, and they said, "No," says, "not tonight," and he says, "but y'all can, you're welcome to stay here, it's getting dark, and this old farmer said you can just stay here for the night," and he says, "but we just got this little bitty bedroom," and says, "there's not going to be but enough room for two people in there. One of you are going to have to sleep out in the barn." And the husband said, "There's an outside door there, and you can come out." And so the husband said, "After all the trouble I put this family through during my drinking," he says, "it's just been terrible." He says, "I know, but y'all just put up with so much." He says, "I'll go sleep in the barn. It'll be fine with me." And so he left, and the daughter and the mother started getting to bed. And finally, they came back, and he hadn't been out there but about half an hour, and he came back in. They barely asleep, and he knocked on the door, and he just says, "Honey," says, "I just can't sleep out there," says, "the goats and the chickens and the pigs and the cows are just making so much noise," says, "I just can't sleep," says, "I hadn't been stopped drinking about 2 weeks, my sleep's still not very good," and says, and I need my sleep right now, what might happen, and they said, the teenage daughter said, "Well, Dad, you come in here, we don't want you to, get all upset or anything, you come in here and sleep, and, I'm the youngest one in the family, and I can be okay here, it'll be all right," says, "y'all ought to spend the night together anyway, and I'm the youngest," so she went out there, and about 20 minutes later, there's this little knock, knock, knock at the door, and it was a teenage daughter, and she came in, she says, I tried to sleep out there," she says, "but the goats and the chickens and the pigs and the cows," says, "they're just making so much noise," says, "I just don't know what to do, I just can't do this, I can't sleep," and the wife just said, "Okay, it's to be just like it always has. Nothing ever changes. Says I've always had to take care of the family. I've always had to do this. No one will ever help me out. I'm not going to get a good night's sleep. I will go out there and take care of it just like I always have. And, everything will just be all right. I'll go do it." So she walks out, and about, hadn't been gone 15 or 20 minutes, and there's this little knock at the door, and there are the cows and the chickens and the goats and the pigs. So hopefully I'll be able to share a little recovery today so we can keep the barnyard animals where they belong, you know, in the barn, and we won't be running them out today. The alcohol, Michael, when she was going through her big book study some yesterday, you know, they always talk about the real alcoholic. You know, I've always been a little jealous of that. I wonder, what's a real Al-Anon? Well, I know what maybe I'm a real candidate for Al-Anon. I was thinking, as I was listening to her, I said, I'm the grandson of an alcoholic. I'm the son of an alcoholic. I'm the husband of an alcoholic. I'm the father of an alcoholic. I'm real worried about my brother. My sister married a guy who I think quit drinking while he could because he realized he was losing control and he hadn't had a drink in a while. Seems to be fine not doing it, but at least he was, I think if he hadn't stopped, he would have been an alcoholic. I got another, one of my other brother married an alcoholic and divorced her. I got lots of alcoholics in the family, plus lots of friends and everything. Also, my wife and I, we have functional dysfunctional families. I think my family's a little bit more, we say that my family's a little bit more obviously dysfunctional than hers was. But the two of us, I've got two brothers and two brother-in-laws. I've got two current sisters-in-law, and I have four ex-sisters-in-law. Okay? So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of material there to talk about. So I think I'm a real Al-Anon. A real Al-Anon. All right. Or at least a real candidate for Al-Anon. It's always, I never know where my story's going to go, because there's a lot to talk about. We're not supposed to talk about the alcoholic, but my wife's my primary alcoholic, and I do like to talk about her some, and I like to talk about my children some, and kind of get that over, because I've given up talking chronologically, because I always get stuck in the past, and I want to share some of the present, you know, with you. And one thing that's kind of hard, even as much as we in Al-Anon like to say that our recovery is our own recovery, and it doesn't matter what the alcoholic's doing, sometimes it just kind of helps to get that out of the way, and let you know what's, you know, kind of what the situation is there. My wife and I both started coming to AA and Al-Anon in 1979 in Dallas, Texas, and I've been coming ever since. That's 23 years next month. Never had been to some open AA meetings with my father because he was sober in AA before that time, and my other mother, who he married after my parents were divorced. He married my other mother, Lillian Miller. I said I love Buck's wife, Lillian. They shared that name, and she was a joy. And Maddie Lou spoke about her, and many old timers know her, knew her well. My wife took her a couple of years to get sober. Now, you know, she wasn't drinking continuously, but a couple of years to get any time of continuous sobriety. She had about 4 years of continuous sobriety. That gets us about to 1986. She drank again, had off and on for a year, then had 10 years of continuous sobriety, drank again, had 2 years of continuous sobriety, drank again, then a year, and she now has 3 months of continuous sobriety. And I'm very, very joyful about that. She's been to 90 meetings in 90 days, and she would be here with me this weekend, but she's also a bowler, and they have their state bowling association meeting, and she's a delegate to that from the Columbus area, so this is a long-standing commitment. During all that time of 23 years, she's never stopped going to meetings. Now, she may go to more sometimes and less at sometimes, and 90 meetings in 90 days, even after, you know, being in the program for 23 years, is a good deal, and it seems to be working today. But that's her story. That's her story. Her struggles and is her story. The thing that I can tell you my story is I'm glad I never stopped coming to Al-Anon. So every once in a while in our Al-Anon group, my home group, we'll talk about relapse, and I'll say, well, I'm one of the lucky ones. Because I hear some people say sometimes, you know, my spouse had been sober 5 years or 10 years or 15 years or 20 years, but you know, I don't know what I'd do if he or she started drinking again. And I'll say, well, I'm one of the lucky ones. I know my program works. I know I'll be okay. And I know that I can be happy and joyous and free whether or not my alcoholic is drinking or not. Now, I know which way I prefer it. No doubt. You know, I have my preferences here. But during those times, during her drinking, when I've had to apply the program perhaps a bit, with a bit more diligence, I've learned probably more than those periods of time when she wasn't drinking. And besides, out of the last 23 years, she's probably been sober 21 out of those 23 years, you know, and probably a lot more than that. And that's a miracle. It's a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she's a joy, and she's the love of my life. And I hope each of you get to meet her one day, if you haven't met her already. My father was, as I said, was also an alcoholic, and I grew up in that alcoholic home. I have no idea what about me made me growing up in an alcoholic home. You know, I don't know whether or not it'd be the way I was today if I hadn't grown up in an alcoholic home, or if I'd be different, better, worse, I don't know. But I knew I grew up in an alcoholic home and I was affected by that. Now my father was not a get drunk and come home and raise Cain and argue or violent. He was a come home, get drunk and go to bed alcoholic. And if anybody did anything, it was my mother trying to yell at him or get mad at him because, you know, trying to keep him up. All he wanted to do was go to bed. Okay. Later on, he was a professional man, and later on it caused more problems when he began to get drunk and then come home and go to bed, kind of alcoholic. Because I lived in Manchester, a small town, and everybody in town knew. I assumed everybody in town knew my father was an alcoholic, and I was right. And he was professional, and as his practice gradually declined, it affected me. I knew that when I was in football practice in high school, and one of my friends would say, "Hey, Jim, your dad's drunk up in the stands watching you." He didn't have to yell at me. He didn't have to get violent. He didn't have to beat me. That was bad enough for me. His office was right across from the school, and when the school secretary would call and say, "Hey, they need you over at your dad's office," and he was too drunk to see patients, and his staff wanted me to take him home to my grandparents where he was living at that time after my parents were divorced. That was bad enough for me. When I was at a scout camp, and a scout leader touched me inappropriately, and I was horrified, and I was ashamed, and I didn't know what to do. And I thought, when I get home from this camping trip, I'm going to tell my daddy. And when I got home, my daddy was too drunk, and I couldn't tell him. That was enough for me. And I never told anyone about that until my second, fourth step in Al-Anon. Buried it deep down inside. Never shared that from the podium before, and just never planned to. But I have to believe that we will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us, and something this morning told me I should share that. But it was enough. My father was not there for me when I needed him. And every young teenage man needs a father in his life, or someone like that. And I didn't have it. That was bad enough. Now, I'm glad he didn't beat me. But it was bad enough for me. And, you know, I have to remember that. You know, I have to remember it's bad enough for me, because as we come into rooms of Al-Anon and we hear various stories and we can compare and contrast and say this wasn't as bad or that wasn't as bad, you know, yeah, it's just bad enough for us. We each have our own story. And in fact, I know that through the years, comparing and contrasting is a bad thing for me. I said that, you know, one of my goals and one of the slogans that I've kind of dealt with is I'm no better than any other man and I'm no worse than any other man. I'm just another man. Because I've spent a lot of my life using the pulley system, you know. I was a great student in school, you know, valedictorian in my class, blah, 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 blah. Okay? Because I could be better than. But you see, the thing is, when I'm better than on the pulley system, somebody else is down here. Somebody else is worse than. You know, or I'm worse than. I'm not a very good football player. That means I'm less of a man than the guys who do play football better than I do. I'm worse than. I'm worse, they're better. I'm better, they're worse. The pulley system. Al-Anon has allowed me, in many areas, not perfectly, to cut those strings of the pulley system and say, I am who I am. you are who you are. It doesn't have to be a contrast. It doesn't have to be a competition. It doesn't have to be a I'm better than. It doesn't have to be a I'm worse than, because both of those damage my soul. And that's Al-Anon. Sharing in meetings. So Al-Anon is just sharing in meetings and hearing things that you hear and just listening and just accepting. You know? Just accepting. You know, one of my favorite definitions, you know, and things happen and you have to move on. You know? You have to move on. Yeah? And things happen to other people and you have to help them move on. Not forget, not to pretend it didn't happen, but to do as I am today. You know? One of my I heard and at a meeting one time that acceptance is just giving up all hope of a better past. Well, it's just the way it is. My life's been rougher than some maybe, and less rough than others. But you know, it's my life, and nothing's going to change that. But I can change who I am today. I wish I could give credit to this. I was thinking as something Beth said last night, and actually every speaker, because Michael, Beth, and Buck have thought of this. There's a Jewish rabbi of several centuries ago, and I wish I had his name. I wish I could give proper reference. But in Judaism, you know, the first commandment, the most important commandment is, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." And this Jewish rabbi said that every day he had to pray for the sin of idolatry, because the God he prayed to yesterday was a false God, because every day he learned something new about God, and so that the God he prayed to today was different. Yeah. You know, how I wish I could say that, how I wish I could claim that spiritually I grew every day, so yesterday I felt like, well, man, I mean, I knew nothing about God yesterday, you know, because I've learned something today about that, you know, I've progressed. You know, and in that way, same way, is this is not a way of saying I'm mad at myself because I didn't know more yesterday, but isn't it wonderful that I know more today? That spiritual progress, you know, claiming spiritual, you know, progress, not spiritual perfection. You know, maybe I can claim monthly rather than daily, or bi-monthly rather than daily, or you know, sometimes during periods of slow growth, maybe every 6 months. I don't know, but you know, I know I'm better. I know I made progress over 10 years ago. I'm sure I made progress over the 23 years where I came into Al-Anon. You know, absolutely. You know, I teach Sunday school today. I teach Sunday school to 11th and 12th graders, and been doing it. You know, and it's wonderful. You know, Al-Anon's allowed me to do that. Al-Anon's given me the sense that a God of my understanding that I can do and that I can help teach them. And you know what? A lot of what I tell them is just right out of the 12 steps. You know? I just use Bible verses, you know, rather than quotes from the big book or our Al-Anon literature, you know, because spiritual principles are all the same. Spiritual principles are all the same. Well, let's get back to some chronology. I grew up in that alcoholic home with that father who was drunk when I came home from that scout camp. And I kept quiet and silent for 16 years because of it. I might have chickened out. Who knows? I might have chickened out and not told him anyway. I look back at that young man. I'm not real proud of who he was. During that time, as I said, my father was a dentist. Manchester was a small town. We lived in the largest house in Manchester, and I was very, very proud of that fact. First house with central air conditioning. I was very proud of that fact. It made us very popular because all the kids wanted to come play at my house because it was centrally air conditioned. But I was proud of that. And it came time for my father to buy a new car. And we were going to get a Ford. We were getting a Ford, and it was the first year of the Ford Galaxy LTD. And there's a huge, huge, is top of the line Ford at that time. Huge promotional campaign. It was quieter than a Rolls Royce. I remember the commercials. You know, I loved the idea. Ford Galaxy LTD. You know, that was going to be a family car. You know, and my father came home and he had a Ford Galaxy. Period. Not a Ford Galaxy, LTD. And I was pissed. Because you see, I thought somehow I deserved to ride around in a top of the line car. That's who I was at age 14. the very last prayer I would ever pray today is, God, please give me what I deserve. You know? The very last prayer. You know, so much would be taken away. Not because I'm a terrible person, but because so much more has been given to me than has been given to the normal person, child of God on this planet. You know, I don't deserve to be born in the United States. Why am I born here? And some people get born in Afghanistan. Do I deserve to get born here and they deserve to get born there? I don't think so. If somebody believes that, please come up and explain that to me afterward, you know. You know? Why do I have enough to eat and a lot of the world's people not have enough to eat? I don't know. You know, I was born in a family that was dysfunctional, but yeah, it was expected you were going to get an education college-wise, and I've just followed the rules in my family, and yeah, I just went ahead and did that. So yeah, I've managed to do pretty well in life, but I just happened to be born into a family that education was important, and I did what was expected of me. Yeah, not because I was anybody special or worked especially hard. I just happened to be born into that family. You know, lots of dysfunction, but some good things too. I don't want what I deserve. I don't want what I deserve. Before my parents were divorced, I remember my mother took me out for a ride one Sunday afternoon. She said, Jim, now this is what, I have no idea what my mother said. All right, I was 14 years old. I was the oldest child at home. I've got an old brother who's 9 years older than me, a sister who's 5 years older than me, and a brother who's 1 year younger. I was the oldest boy at home. And I think, you know, my mother was a little bit unfair to me, at least in my perception. But she took me out, and what I remember her asking was, is, Jim, do I have your permission to divorce your father? I want to divorce your father. Is that okay with you? Now, I have no idea what she said, but that's what I heard. And, of course, I said, no, that's not okay. I mean, no, children don't want their parents to be divorced. And, you know, and she did anyway a while later, a couple of years later. But I remember that. You know? I remember that. My mother desperately needs Al-Anon. As I said, she grew up in an alcoholic home. Her father was an alcoholic, and I mean, he must have been pretty bad off, because, you know, my grandmother divorced him in 1944 in a little town in Georgia, and that's pretty unusual. But she grew up in that alcoholic home, and she's married to my father, and they eventually got divorced. And my mother's an interesting person. She's she has a lot of grace. She's 84 now and still very vigorous, and she has a lot of grace, and she has a lot of social skills, and people like her, and she's funny, and you can tell dirty jokes to her. You know, at 84, that's pretty. You know, that's a nice thing. You know, she can laugh at them and enjoy it. But and she's improved with age. Because for a lot of times, my mother would, I think I've been picked on more than most, but my mother was the kind that we could never quite do enough. And there was that phone call. If you didn't call and talk to her, you'd get what my brothers and sisters and I call the phone call from hell. Why haven't you called? You don't love me. What's wrong? Blah, 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 you know? And it just used to tear me apart. Just tear me apart. And then in Al-Anon, you know, and then she'd hang up and, you know, your job was to call her back. Yeah. In Al-Anon, I learned after a while, and you know, and I stopped doing that. And when she'd say, "Jim, you're just the worst child a mother could ever want, you know, could have, you know, just you're just a horrible son," and I'd say, "Yes, Mom, I know you felt that way. You've been telling me that since I was about 18 years old, and so I guess there has to be some truth in it. I know you feel that way," and you know, that'd really make her mad, because what she wanted was argument. You know, what she wanted was argument. But, you know, I remember the time in Al-Anon, and I mean, there's a lot of growth. You have to, I don't think, you know, I had to be about 35 before this started. But my mother called. Don't talk about my mother very much in my talk anyway. So y'all are, you know, my mother called me, and she hung up on me. She was living in St. Petersburg, Florida at the time, and she did that, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" And she hung up on me, and I didn't call her back. In fact, I took the phone off the hook. And the next morning she called, and she said, "I tried, you didn't call back, and you didn't call back last night. What was wrong?" And I said, "Well, Mom, I decided that I'm going to give you the respect that you deserve. You obviously didn't want to talk with me because you hung up on me, and I'm going to give you the respect that you deserve and assume that when you did want to talk with me, you'd call me again." Now, my brothers and my sister still don't handle mom as well as I do. And in fact, in doing that, what they did is they began to come to me. Now, you know, I'm one of the middle children, you know, and that. But they come to me and they say, well, when there's bad news for mom, Jim, you're the only one who can handle or you do it. And you know what? The way I handle mom is I started being honest with mom. In fact, they'd say that. They said, Jim, we always tell her what she wants to hear. You always tell her what's the truth. Here, you got to do this. You know? And I started doing that. And you know what? It's a lot better today. She still needs Al-Anon very, very badly. I'm not saying that meetings wouldn't be a great deal of help to her. But you know, I got better in Al-Anon, and I began to act in an honest way with my mother, and our relationship improved. You know? And if I got the phone call from hell, it didn't tear me up for weeks. It didn't make me resent the next phone call. It didn't make me not want to call her. Because that's what the last, you know, it's like, oh, I don't want this. It didn't make me cringe every time she called. You know, what it is it's a lot better today. I've got a better relationship with her than I have probably in my entire life, but only because of Al-Anon. And because I started doing that, my brothers and my sister, who don't go to Al-Anon, started doing a little bit more of it too. Huh? And it's improved. The ripple effect. One person in the family improves and the relationships improve even if the other people don't. My father got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He sobered up at John Mooney's house, Dr. John Mooney in Statesboro, Georgia, and he was sobering up drunks in his house at that time. And my father went there, got sober, and he came home on the day that I graduated from high school, as I've already mentioned, valedictorian. I'll just throw that in twice. And he was sober for 5 years before he died in an auto accident. That was in 1974. So he died. During that time, he married Lillian, who I mentioned before, my Lillian Miller, not Buck's Lillian Miller, and she was our other mother. And I saw a marriage between my father and this woman who had had about 8 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time before they got married, and I had modeled before me. Wonderful, true, unconditional love for each other. You know? So there was that 14-year-old boy who I still think my mother was unfair to ask me for permission to divorce my father. But I didn't want it to happen, but it did happen. And if it hadn't happened, Lillian would have never been in my life. Yeah. Beautiful woman. And after my father died, she used to come and spend time with Christy and me after we were married. And she'd come and just spend the weekend with us. And she'd go to AA meetings, and we'd go to a meeting with her, open AA meetings, because I'd been with them in their house, because their house was an open AA house. It's a beautiful open AA house, and they always had a coffee pot on, and people would always come in. And my dad brought home prisoners from the work camp for Thanksgiving dinner, who were pigeons of his, who he was taking to meetings. And it was just such a beautiful model. So when the time came for Christy and me to be in the program, we had this model of love and of unconditional love in the program, and I have to be grateful for that. But Lillian came in, and it was wonderful, and she and Dad were great, and he gave me a big book, and I read the big book. In fact, I actually had it up on the wall, I had it up on the bookshelf in my college dormitory, and I had several friends, for a couple of fraternity brothers, who'd see it there, and they'd kind of take it down. I'd say, "Yeah, my father's a recovering alcoholic," and they'd say, "My dad's an alcoholic," and we actually got to discuss that somewhat, even before I came to a meeting for myself. I'd been to open meetings of AA, and so even then, just having the big book allowed me to perhaps touch somebody's life or open their eyes or open a door. Fell in love with Christy. And we got married. I graduated from college, and then she graduated from college, and then I went off to medical school together, and she worked and put me through medical school. And we partied on the weekends. I often say Christy has this tremendous. I mean, you know, she can drink a quart of vodka a day, and I can't tell she's drinking. She's got a tremendous tolerance. Okay, I don't. So I often say that still, even today, she has seen me drunk more often than I've seen her drunk. because she'd have all this drive. She'd drink more than I did. I'd get drunk, and she'd drive me home, you know, in college. You know, that continued in medical school. You know, we'd party on the weekends. We both did drinking, but it was fun drinking. Didn't seem that much different than anybody else. In Christy's story, she'll say that she felt some that there are differences, but neither one of us saw them at the time. Graduated from medical school and went off to Dallas, Texas, to do my internship and residency at Parkland Memorial Hospital, and that's a hard time, internship and residency. 36 hours in the hospital, 12 hours home, 12 hours at the hospital, 12 hours home, 36 hours in the hospital, a couple hours sleep if you're lucky when you're on call. It's a hard time, and you see, we had a one-year-old. We had a daughter who was born during that time. And Christy was working full time, and the mother of this child, and I was working more than full time. And we kind of took some time apart because during internship and residency, you don't have much energy to do anything else. There's no social life. There's no nothing. When you're home, you're eating or sleeping. And you see, so I took kind of a. It was okay though. Because, you see, we thought we had the perfect marriage. So it was all right for me to take just a three-year kind of move away. You know, I mean, we're living together, but just kind of moving away for 3 years and being all right not to do that and not work on the marriage and not have much social life together, because if you have the perfect marriage, what? You don't have to work on perfection. You know, we were just the perfect young couple, you know? Yeah. And so everything seemed to be going okay. Even though we weren't talking that much or... I was tired. When I came home, you know, she was just real sweet. She tried to put me to bed real quickly. And I didn't know anything was going on until one night I arrived into a darkened apartment, our daughter asleep in her bedroom at 1 year old, and my wife told me the story of her drug addiction. She was addicted to painkillers, and she was taking about 30 Percodan a day. She had a high tolerance for Percodan, too. We called Lillian. I asked her if she thought she needed to be detoxed in the hospital, and she said, oh, no, I'll be okay. And she detoxed at home, and that's a horrible experience. Opioid detox is a horrible experience. She did it at home, and she's feeling awful. And she called Lillian just because Lillian was back in Georgia, and she called Lillian and said, Lillian, she didn't tell her what was wrong. She just says, I need you. And Lillian was on the plane the next morning to come to Dallas, Texas. Now, Lillian later shared to us, she says, I wonder what that boy has done to her. And she's my other mother, not her other mother. But Christy told her the story of her drug addiction, and Lillian smiled. And at that time, I guess, she'd had 15 years of sobriety. And Lillian just smiled and said, let's go to a meeting. You know, Christy, it never occurred to her that Lillian would take her to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But she took her to a meeting. And while Lillian was still out there, I went to my first meeting of Al-Anon in April of 1979. And I went into this group, and they said, oh, so does your wife have a drinking problem? And I said, oh, no, she's a very successful drinker. I don't mind that. So she's just got a drug problem. And they just patted me on the back, and they said, keep coming back. Now, I'm real glad they did, and I understand singleness of purpose, but I'm glad that I'm glad people didn't say, we don't like your kind here. We have another place that you can go. They said, keep coming back. And 2 months later, I knew alcohol was a problem. We'd come back east, as I learned to call it in Texas, and to North Carolina, and we were staying at a brother's house. He was gone the first night, and we were staying back. We were visiting around to see places for me to practice. And the first night that we were back, we'd left our daughter with Lillian. Lillian was taking care of her while we were on this little trip because we were looking for places that we might want to live for the rest of our life. It was about a year before we left. And Christy began to act strangely. Her thought processes were not clear. Her gait was not exactly right, and her speech was slightly garbled. Now, I've had 4 years of an excellent undergraduate education at Duke University, 4 years of medical school at the Medical College of Georgia, and have finished 2 years at Parkland Memorial Hospital. And so I immediately thought, she's either had a slight stroke or acute Alzheimer's disease. Not wanting to embarrass her, I mentioned nothing about my fact that I had observed odd behavior on her part, and we both went to sleep, and I woke up the next morning, and the syndrome of the previous night had disappeared, which made me very, very happy. The next night, her brother came home, and while since we were all having dinner together, he suggested that we might want to have a drink before dinner, and I said, fine. And after a drink or two, Christy making sure that she was the one mixing the drinks, the syndrome of the night before reappeared, and I thought, aha, she's drunk! But see, it never occurred to me that the previous night she could be drunk because we weren't drinking. How could she be? We weren't drinking. When I finally knew, I knew alcohol was a problem, because Christy had immediately gone from drugs to alcohol. And of course, she was secretive drinking. And because even though we had drunk together during that period of time, because I didn't have any problem with her drinking, I'd never seen any real problem with that, she was drinking all the time. Yeah. Alcohol was a problem. And alcohol has been a drug of choice since that time. I went to Al-Anon, as I said, and they told me to keep coming back, and I have, and I've been coming back ever since. Went to those meetings, the family afterward meetings, you know, where we talked about humor, and I talked about Euripides. That was pretty still pretty embarrassing. I still have a resentment against that woman, by the way. she's a lovely Al-Anon lady. But I was hooked. And I think I was hooked. Some of that is because I'd seen what AA and Al-Anon had done for what AA had done for Dad and Lillian, and I'd seen the wonderful life that had done, and I'd met the wonderful friends, and I'd gotten a glimmer of that, and so it was okay. It was okay to go to meetings. Christy didn't get sober immediately, as I said. We moved to Columbus, Georgia, you know, a little bit afterward. And, you know, it's crazy. Now, there is a problem, you understand, here, because, see, I had been coming to Al-Anon for 2 months before I thought that drinking was a problem. Okay? So, I would go to meetings and listen to y'all tell your stories about how you used to hunt for bottles and laugh with you about how stupid that was. And then I'd go home and hunt for bottles because I'd never done it before. Yeah. I mean, there was one time, Bob and Carol were coming over. There's a friend of mine who was in internship with me. They were coming over, and I looked out, and I said, here, Bob and Carol are coming over. Wouldn't it be great? Says, nobody ever comes over anymore, because by the time, you know, we were going to meetings, and we had no time for social life. We were going to meetings, and Bob and Carol, wouldn't that be great? And Christy says, I do not want to see them. I don't want to see them. And I said, well, but they're coming over there. And he says, we can hide in the hallway and pretend we aren't here. And you know, they'll go away. And Christy was right. We hid in the hallway. They knocked on the door. And we pretended that we weren't there, and they went away just like she planned. Now, for Christy, I mean, she didn't want to see them. She made a plan. We carried it out. I wanted to see them, and I was hiding in the hallway. Some are sicker than others. Although I knew at meetings I had a lot up here, I was still acting in strange ways. It was as if I can just make her feel guilty enough, she'll stop drinking. Even at that time I knew she felt guilty. I'd heard enough people at open AA meetings, and thank the Lord for open AA meetings, open AA speaker meetings, because I heard things that Christy couldn't tell me, and I believed them because I heard them over and over again. But you know, I'd want to make her feel guilty. I remember our little one-year-old happened to find a bottle, and I don't know how she found one, and we were talking on the phone either with her mom and with Christy's mother and father, and we were talking on the phone, and I was on the phone in the bedroom, she was on the phone in the kitchen, and Ray, our daughter, you know, probably about two at that time, was dragging this half gallon of bourbon into the room, and I said, go take it to your mother. So I dragged it in, and as soon as she walked into the kitchen with it, I mean, Christy didn't know that, I could hear the change in Christy's voice and that worry about, did Jim see this? Increasing her guilt doing that. Now, I had a problem because, see, Christy was always stopping and starting and stopping. And if I caught her drinking, then she'd pick up another white chip. And she picked up lots of white chips, you know. But if I caught her drinking and I happened to go to the open AA meeting, she'd pick up another one. If I didn't, you know. So since she was stopping and starting all the time, I had a problem because if I found a bottle, I was a champion bottle hunter. I mean, that's just really embarrassing, you know. It's really embarrassing. I mean, I'd hunt for bottles and I'd close the curtains because I was afraid somebody would see me hunting for bottles. I don't know, you know. Now, I'd get undressed with the curtains open. You know, I didn't mind anybody seeing me in my underpants, but you know, I want to see them, you know, hunting for bottles, you know. And you know, but I'd hunt for bottles, and then when I find it, Christy'd say, "Well, you know, most of them were empty. You know, most of them were empty." And she'd say, "Well, Jim, I've already picked up the white chip for that one. You know, I've quit now, so that's an old one." So what I'd have to do, is I'd have to find one that had some in it, mark it, put it back, go back 6 hours, 12 hours, 24 hours later, and then I had proven that she had drunk in the last 12 hours. I'd probably been in the program for 6 or 8 years before a good friend of mine in Al-Anon said, "The truth does not always matter." Because you see, I always thought the truth mattered. You had to know the truth. You had to know the facts. Because see, because I'm smart. I was a valedictorian, remember? And if I knew the truth and I knew the facts, I was smart enough to figure it out. And if I could figure it out, I realize now I thought I could control it and have power over it. That's why I think we in Al-Anon, or the candidates for Al-Anon, or people in Al-Anon who are sick as I am, hunt for bottles, because we think if we know the truth, then we can do something about it. Some of you have hunted for bottles, haven't you? Please tell me you have. Yeah. Why we give the Al-Anon kiss? You know the Al-Anon kiss? Yeah. You know? Yeah. If we can smell it and we know they're drinking, there's something we can do about it. Thanksgiving of this year, my daughter who's graduated from college and is in Houston, Texas, and my daughter who's in college, my son was not there, I'll have time to talk about him, but our youngest daughter who was in high school, our girls were home for Thanksgiving, and it turned out my whole family has Thanksgiving at my sister's house, but they had their hot water heater busted. Just couldn't do it 1 week before, so my wife wound up doing it at our house. You know, about 30 people there, and that went well. But a few days before Thanksgiving, maybe not a few days, maybe early November, I was suspicious that Christy had been drinking again. And you know, and every time I think, well, you know, maybe I'm wrong this time, but I'm always right. I know, you know, nothing obvious. And, you know, as it got time for Thanksgiving, I thought, well, the whole family's here, and, you know, maybe I ought to say something. But I decided not to. And I've gone through this once or twice before, and the thing is that, you know, because I have two mixed feelings about it. Number one is I'm not going to have an elephant in my living room and walk around and pretend it's not there. But if that elephant is small enough that I'm the only one that sees it, and it's this little bitty elephant that's hiding in the rug, do I really need to, and there's nothing I can do about it, is there any need to really do anything about it? And I didn't say anything to the family. And it was about 3 or 4 days after Thanksgiving that Christy asked for help and said she'd been drinking and that she wanted to stop. You know, I'm glad I didn't say anything. Because you see, her drinking didn't ruin Thanksgiving. If I had insisted on a family council meeting, I would have ruined Thanksgiving. Why? Why would I have done that? Well, because somehow I would have thought that, yeah, the truth has to come out, because if we bring this out and we have a family council meeting, there's something we can do about this. We can stop this drinking. We have power over this. Yeah. But, you know, I had to let it go, and I waited until Christy asked for help. And she only asked for help when she knew that her drinking was so far out of control that it was obvious. My daughter was on her way home and she realized, I'm drunk and everybody's going to know it. Home from school. And I'm so glad I waited. Now, one of those other times I had waited up to a certain point because I'd been, you know, it's funny how, you know, I can't smell it over the phone. But I remember the first one, in one of those times of relapses, we were at a Christmas party and my wife took her hand and put it on my knee, on my thigh at this party. We were sitting at dinner and I thought, she's drinking. That's how she touches me when she's drinking. Isn't that incredible? No behavior, just something about that. I'm that attuned. Huh? And at that time I'd waited, but you know, the thing that I waited until I said, I look, because as soon as any of my children suspected, I said, then we're going to talk, because I'm not going to sit around and let them worry about this. And as it turned out, I've been able to do that, because I'm not going to let them worry. You know, as soon as I think that they are suspicious, I've always said, then we've got to talk, because that's not trying to do something about their drinking, that's taking care of my children. That's taking care of my children. I have to mention John, and my time's running out. John's third. He'll be 31 next month. He's got he'll have 13 years of sobriety. He joined us. He joined my family when he was 17. We invited him in. He was reluctant at first, but we invited him into our family, and he's. He's my. We don't know what to call him. Well, actually, our daughters call him non-con John. That's non-consanguineal John. That means a non-blood relative. But he's their non-con brother, non-consanguineal brother, no blood relation. So he's non-con John. My youngest daughter, who's 17, doesn't remember when John wasn't in the family, and he lived with us for 6 or 7 years. He's been married for 2 years, and that's a whole other story. You know, that's another hour talk. I'll be giving that one immediately after this one for those of you. In my room, there'll be plenty of room for everyone there, so who wants to hear? But I have to mention John, because John's one of those things that we will intuitively know how to handle situations. For some reason, bringing John into my family felt like the thing I was supposed to do. And I don't know why. I mean, I believe God sent him to us, and it was mine to accept or not to accept. But it was difficult to bring a young man of 17 or 18 into a family with three girls. You know? Yeah. It was difficult. But he's been a joy. He's a sports buff. My wife's a great sports fan. I'm a great sports fan, and we are definitely going to get out of here by 4 o'clock when Duke starts to play basketball this afternoon. And he's been a real joy. Been sober, and I learned so much in helping that young man. I think it's very, very special, because I feel like that he's the son that Christy and I didn't have, and God sent him to me. And it's only through the fellowships of AA and Al-Anon that that's possible. I was the best man at his wedding. He waited too damn long to ask me, though. You know, he waited until about 3 months before the wedding before he asked. And I had argued, but you know what? I had worked there, and I said, I'm going to be John's best man, you know? I just assumed that. And then he didn't ask, and he didn't ask, and he didn't ask. And then I said, I worked through the fact, well, if John doesn't ask me to be the best man in his wedding, that's okay. I had to let go of it. And once I'd let go of it, he asked me, and I said, why did you wait so blanking long? And he said, I wanted it to be special, and I wanted it to be at a time when we were together, and we'd spend an evening. It was a time when we could spend an evening together as we could talk about it. And he said, I just didn't want to just ask you. I wanted it to be a special evening together. We smoked cigars, you know. Yeah, what a joy. Without Al-Anon, without AA, John would not be a part of our life. And at one point when Christy was in treatment and in a halfway house for a year and away from home, John took care of the family. He took the girls to school. He brought the girls home. He did the laundry. He cleaned. I did the grocery shopping and I did the cooking. But he did everything else. And he kept the family together. So that when Christy was sober and Christy returned home, we were there waiting for her. You know? What a wonderful and glorious and gracious God have I found in this program who's provided me with that. I want to spend just a moment. There are other things I could tell you. Lots of other things. But I hope that you know me a little bit better now. As I said, I'm the only one that can do that. You see, I'm worth knowing. I'm a prince. and you're a prince or a princess. And, you know, my father is a king, and so that makes me a prince. And as long as I, and that's wonderful if I remember that I'm a prince, as long as I also remember that you are a princes and princesses also. Because then I'm off that pulley system, and we're just fellow human beings. And that's a wonderful thing. I want to close, as I always do, with a prayer that's in our Al-Anon literature and in the AA literature. It's originally, Bill Wilson put it in the 12 and 12. It's a prayer that was written by a man named Francis, who came from a little hill town in Assisi. And that little hill town in Assisi is probably one of the most spiritual places I've ever visited, and I've had the distinct pleasure of being there three times in my life. Several years ago, I took my whole family there. My wife and I went there while I was still in medical school, and then I went there in college, and then when I went back to Europe, and my wife and I were able to go, and then I took my whole family to Italy about 5 years ago, and seven of us, another young man who's kind of like a son too, and again, that's a whole other story, Bobby. And I took the seven of us to Italy, and we went to Assisi, and you know, I didn't think they got it, you know. I didn't think they got it. You know, they just didn't understand. I wanted them to think as much of Assisi in the spiritual place as I did. And then we'd gotten back, and about 2 years later, a year or 2 years later, is when they had the earthquakes in Assisi. And the first things, we did not know how much damage was done to this glorious churches and this beautiful art and the place where Francis lived and worked and died and is buried. And I started crying. I was hearing the reports on my way home, and I started crying because it's such a beautiful place. And the first reports, we didn't know. I mean, the town could have been rubble. And I was crying. And when I got home, my whole family was around the TV looking at it, and tears were coming out of their eyes, too. They got it. They got it. I just didn't think they had. I couldn't make them get it. See, that's the thing, is I wanted to make them get it. Yeah. But they got it despite that. So I close with that prayer and with fond memories of that hilltop town and the beauty of it and the beauty of that church. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. I used to think that eternal life was something that happened after we died and had something to do with streets of gold and pearly gates, but today I believe that eternal life is something that I'm sitting right smack in the middle of, living one day at a time. Thank you.